All right, good morning. Today we're continuing our study of the Song of Solomon, Solomon on Love, Sex, and Marriage. And we come to the fifth lesson, and we're calling it Deepening Love because we've seen the young couple meet and go through their romance, courtship time, and their marriage, their wedding night. We've seen them go through a period of conflict, and as conflict often does, if handled the right way with a strong commitment to love, it yields a deeper, more mature love in the end. And I think that's what we will see today as we look at the progress in the book of how they have moved through the different stages of marriage. And next week will be our last lesson, and we'll kind of show how strong their love is in the concluding parts of the Song of Solomon. But today we're going to see how their marriage has matured through the year, whether a poetic year or a figurative year, whatever. What we see is some references to springtime, which makes us kind of feel that as the book began in the spring, now it's back to spring again. So it's kind of cycled through, whether that's figuratively or real time. The point is that the marriage is going through its a cycle, and it's now in a more mature state and after being tested. And next week we'll talk about how their love is affirmed towards one another. So today what we're going to see is that the lovers are going to deepen their sexual intimacy. You thought that we had already gone deep enough for you. It's a challenging class to teach. And today's challenging also, knowing that there are others listening in, and perhaps on the on their internet and so forth. It's challenging to talk about the subject, but it's something that we need to do unashamedly. And then she actually initiates further sexual intimacy with him as well. And then our section closes today with the admonishment for sexual chastity or sexual purity to the young people of the land. So it's springtime again, and let's check in on our lovers and see how they're doing. Well, it begins in chapter 7, verse 1, with a very descriptive, very specific and descriptive picture of her sexual beauty. And we see that it quickly takes a sexual nuance throughout his description. Now, she had praised him in a very descriptive way in chapter 6. And so now he is doing the same with her. At the end of their conflict, when we left them, she had praised him. And at the very end of chapter 6, there's a reference to a dance. And we suggested, though, we were not sure what that means in verse 13. I suggested that that was a dance of reconciliation. It's a joyful dance of reconciliation. If we take that picture of a dance then into chapter 7, we see her still dancing, and he starts with her feet and praises the beauty of her feet in sandals. So the feet are the most integral part in dancing, I guess, because they move the body. So he says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels, the works of the hands of a skillful workman." Well, it doesn't take him long to jump from the feet up to her thighs. And that's why we say this is a description of her physical and sexual beauty. Now, I want you to notice something, because in the ancient culture, as pretty similar to today, women are largely covered up. But he's seeing things that are not seen in public. So that adds to the idea that these are sexual references and done in some kind of enticing dance, or just he's appreciating her in a private setting. So he starts from the feet, and we see a lot of flesh exposed. He compliments her thighs and how beautiful they look. In verse 2, he says, "Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies." The word Nabal here is the only use of the word in the Hebrew language in the Old Testament. So when that happens with the word, we're not always sure what it means. And so what we do is we look at the cognate languages or other ancient literature to see if there's any words that look like that, and then we try to guess what it is. Doing that, I suggest that, not because of my expertise, but just relying on the others, that Nabal's a good translation, especially as you see him ascending in order from the feet to the thighs to the waist area. However, there is a region between the thighs and the waist area, and my Hebrew lexicon actually says that more frequently this word is being translated as vulva. Okay, so just to let you know that the word is preferred by many, and it just adds to the sexual picture here and description of a person. But most of your Bibles are going to say navel, I think, opting for a safer translation. and that's fine because it still fits in the physical description as he ascends in appreciating her beauty. And he compares it, and one of the reasons is, of course, is because he compares it to having a liquid. And here he's talking about a blended beverage or mixed wine. Mixed wine, wine was usually diluted with water in ancient days to make it to go longer. But mixed beverage or mixed wine refers to strong wine mixed with a weaker wine so that you actually get a better and stronger beverage. So it was very, very intoxicating. So what he's saying is that he's really getting intoxicated by her looks or by her sexual and physical beauty. And he's getting drunk on her. Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies. Lilies have been a reference in the past to beauty and sexuality. And here he sees her waist area as a heap of wheat. A heap of wheat, of course, if we had kernels of wheat, would be golden in color and very pretty in color. We have a very familiar reference in verse 3 to the breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. We've seen that already, and we talked about that already. He keeps ascending in his description to her neck. It's like an ivory tower. I think that would be a picture of being smooth and fair-colored and strong, and her eyes like pools in Heshbon. The pools of Heshbon were known to be very... they were well-known pools, and it was an area that was associated with fertility because of the water that was there and the reservoirs that were there. So probably a reference to tranquility, perhaps fertility. By the gate of Bath Rabin. Now, the gate areas were a very important area where the elders sat and decisions were made, but we don't know what Bath Rabin refers to. Nobody knows of such a place. So that is something that there is... I did not find a good, reasonable translation or picture from that. Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks towards Damascus. Seems to be speaking of her orientation, her purpose, her desires, being strong and firm, like a tower that's on the lookout tower. And... pointing north. Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel. I do have a picture of Mount Carmel in the distance, associated with being a wild, rugged area, but a beautiful area. And your hair, the hair of your head is like purple, or purple threads. NIV, I think, says royal tapestry. And that's the idea of purple, is a color associated with royalty. So he's saying that your hair is just, you know, royalty, like royalty. A king is held captive by your tresses. This is interesting here when you think about who King Solomon was, the most powerful man of his day, and yet he's all tangled up and held captive by the threads of her hair. And what a statement of submission of his strength to her beauty. Whereas Samson, you know, maybe makes us think of Samson, and the strength was in his hair. Her hair holds that strength over him. In verse 6, he says, "How fair and pleasant you are, O love, with your delights." We have four descriptive phrases here. Fair, pleasant, calls her love, and delightful. And then he compares her to a palm tree. "The stature of yours is like a palm tree." This would be a date palm tree. And the reference probably refers to her tall and elegant stature. Stately. And he says, "Your breasts like its clusters." Well, what do date palms look like up close? There's the clusters of the dates all together. In some ways, it brings to mind, if he's comparing that to her breasts, it brings to mind abundance, fertility. You know the picture of the god of sex in Greek mythology. Is it Athena? And the temple of Athena had the statue of a woman with you know, hundreds of breasts. So pictorially, that's what he's seeing, and he's comparing her breasts to its clusters. And then he says in verse 8 something interesting. "I will go up to the palm tree and I will take hold of its branches." I'll go up to the palm tree and I will take hold of its branches. Evidently, what they did in ancient days is they would climb the palm tree and they would get the pollen from the male tree and then climb the female tree and dust the blossoms or tie the pollen, stalks of pollen, to the branches of the female tree to fertilize it. And so this seems to be a reference to fertilizing. It's obviously a reference to his sexual intimacy with her. "I'll go up to the palm tree and take hold of its branches and let your breasts be like the clusters of the vine." He could be talking about clusters of date palm nuts, or he could be, dates, or he could be talking about switching the figure, some believe, to grapes now. "Let your breasts also be like clusters of grapes." "The fragrance of your breath like apples." We saw a reference like that earlier in the song, and the reference to apples, of course, was the sweet taste. And in verse 9, "And the roof of your mouth like the best wine." So he is now inside the mouth, describing the inside of the mouth, which is very intimate. But he goes from the feet to the thighs, to the waist area, to the breasts, to the neck and the face, and then focuses in on the breasts. He had talked about the breasts as being like the twins of a gazelle in verse 3. So when you come down to verse 7 and 8 and he refers again to her as a palm tree with the breasts, it's more like his action is emphasized more than the description. This is what he's going to do. He's going to climb the palm tree. So he's actively engaging or describing the sexual relationship here. So he praises her sexual beauty pretty graphically. We've seen that already. What I see here is a little bit more directness and a little more boldness on his part. And that comes with the familiarity of being married. And you will see the same thing with her if you look carefully too. She is fulfilled by his lovemaking. Verse 9. The second part, she speaks. "The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers. I am my beloved, and his desire is toward me." The wine, which speaks of the intoxicating lovemaking, goes down smoothly. It tastes good. And then she talks about, moving gently over the lips of the sleepers. Or one Bible translated, "gliding gently over the lips as we sleep together." In other words, the effects of their lovemaking, as in the afterglow, we'll call it, as they cuddle together, perhaps, is still a sweet taste to her. Good chance that he's probably sound asleep, but she's still But she is enjoying the experience, and I say that for a reason. I'll talk about that in a little bit. But this does seem to be, now that they're sleeping, after the sexual act that he has so graphically talked about when he talked about climbing the palm tree. I think what we might see here is that husbands should help their wives feel good about their bodies, as he does with her. Women tend to be more self-conscious about their bodies, and it's not a good idea for men to joke or be sarcastic or be mean or to compare, but to help your mate feel comfortable with her body. And the women, of course, the man also, but I think women tend to be a little bit more sensitive about their appearances. And we don't want to be like this couple. They both wanted to ask each other what they wanted for Christmas, and she said, boy, well, they had the same thing in mind. A nice sports car. She hinted to him. She said, I want something that'll take me from 0 to 200 miles an hour in under 6 seconds. What do you want? Well, he says, I want something that'll make me look sleek and sexy. So he bought her a bathroom scale. She bought him a treadmill. 0 to 200. That's not a good example of what we're talking about. Be more sensitive to the physical appearance. And, you know, Solomon here is praising his wife's beauty, and one aspect at a time, being very specific. And then she responds by just expressing how fulfilled she is. And now what she does in verse 11 is interesting, because she shows more aggression or boldness or more initiative, maybe a better word, more initiative in the sexual relationship. She invites him to the countryside for a lovemaking episode. Literally to the countryside on a trip, maybe. To visit her family in the countryside, perhaps, because that's where we find them later in chapter 8. Figuratively, is she saying, you know, let's go back and do a romantic type of setting like we used to have before when we were met each other outdoors? Could be. But the point is that she is doing the inviting here. She says in verse 11, come, my beloved, let us go forth into the field and let us lodge in the villages. By the way, I didn't mention verse 10, but if you notice verse 10, there's something very interesting about it. I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me. Previously, she had made the same statement, but she had said, my beloved is mine and I am his. She made the same statement, but this time she only recognizes his love and she doesn't reciprocate with an expression of her love. The idea being, perhaps, that she's just so secure in his love and lost in his love. She doesn't even feel the need to cling or to express her love. She's just so satisfied with his love. I am my beloved and his desire is toward me. Then with that as a basis, she initiates this action in the countryside and invites him to actually lovemaking in the countryside. Verse 12, let us get up early to the vineyards and let us see if the vine has budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom, and there I will give you my love. The references to the vineyard before had referred to her body, but also this herself. Remember, she said, I've kept my vineyard. And later on, there's a similar reference. But perhaps could also be the setting for their outdoor meetings. The idea of the grapes blossoming again would be springtime. And let's see if love is still growing. And pomegranates, as we referred to before, were often associated with sex. And that's been used in the description of her before. And there I will give you my love. Now, verse 13 is interesting, too. It says, the mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits, all manner, new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. mandrakes were associated in the Old Testament times with as an aphrodisiac with fertility. And one of the reasons for that, perhaps, is I chose this picture of many that I found, but they all look fairly similar. And it's been pointed out that the mandrake root looks kind of like a human body. In fact, this looks like two human bodies cuddling. And so there are many depictions of mandrake roots that look like two lovers together. And perhaps that is how it got associated with being an aphrodisiac or sexual stimulant and got associated with sex so much. So in the reference of verse 13 to the, you know, she's smelling the mandrakes and she's under its influence, is definitely a reference to sexual desires. And with the mandrake as something that would stimulate. If you look at Genesis chapter 30, we see a mandrake-soaked story. It's the story of Jacob with his wives, Leah and Rachel. And it says in verse 14, Genesis 30:14, that Reuben went in the days of wheat harvest and found mandrakes in the field and brought them to his mother, Leah. And Rachel, her sister, that is, both married to Jacob, Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me some of your son's mandrakes." Why? Well, she wanted to have children by Jacob. But she, Leah, said to Rachel, "Is it a small matter that you have taken away my husband?" Remember that jealousy they had? "Would you take away my son's mandrakes also?" And Rachel said, "Therefore, he will lie with you tonight for your son's mandrakes." Well, Rachel is saying, "Okay, well, you sleep with him tonight and give me some of the mandrakes." So Jacob came out of the field in the evening, and Leah went out to meet him and said, "You must come in to me, for I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." And he lay with her that night. And God listened to Leah, and she conceived and bore Jacob a fifth son. Well, the mandrakes worked, didn't they? And Leah said, "God has given me my wages because I have given my maid to my husband." So she called his name Issachar. Then Leah conceived again and bore Jacob a sixth son. And Leah said, "God has endowed me with a good endowment. Now my husband will dwell with me because I have borne him six sons." So she called his name Zebulun. And afterwards she bore a daughter and called his name called her name Dinah. Then God remembered Rachel. God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son and said, "God has taken away my reproach." So she called his name Joseph and said, "The Lord shall add to me another son." Wow. Mandrake's working in that family, aren't they? We could do an infomercial and sell a ton of those things if we could get people believing like that. I don't know what's behind it. God was at work, obviously, in the story of Genesis. Whether he chose to work through mandrakes or the belief in mandrakes, I don't know. Maybe there's something that we'll find someday that mandrakes actually do for us. But I didn't do a chemical research on it or medical research on it. Maybe you can do that and tell me what you find. But I guarantee you, we'd probably tear up the countryside looking for mandrakes if they did find anything. So anyway, her reference to mandrakes is obviously a reference to a sexual stimulant, aphrodisiac. And then she talks about our gates being pleasant and fruitful, or over our doors, I think, literally. It seems to be a reference to a place of storage, because she says, "All men are new and old, which I've laid up for you." Oftentimes, over the door would be a shelf, and that's where things would be stored, like the fruits and spices and things like that. And she's saying that, "Hey, I've got some things stored up for you, something new, something old, something familiar, but there's a surprise." So she's building anticipation by the promise of something new, which is interesting. In chapter 8, she yearns to satisfy him with her love making. "Oh, that you were like my brother who nursed at my mother's breast. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you. I would not be despised. I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother. She who used to instruct me, I would cause you to drink of spiced wine or the juice of my pomegranate. Now, that seems odd to us that she would say, oh, that you were like my brother. But if you read on what she's saying, so that I wouldn't be despised. Because in ancient culture, it was looked down upon for even a husband and wife to show physical affection or signs of affection in public. And that's not really odd, because you'll see the same thing in India and Africa today. You don't see husband and wife expressing themselves physically to one another. They don't hardly even hold hands. Very rare to see them hold hands. But yet guy and guy walk down the street holding hands, good friend, best friends and best girlfriends, not homosexual, but best friends will walk down the street holding each other and holding their arms. And that looks unusual to us. But I can only think of one time in India I saw a young boy with his arm around a girl in public. And that struck me as very odd when I saw that at a fair that I was at. In fact, one of the pastors, we went and we met his wife, you know, and then we were where she worked, and then we were saying goodbye to her, and I was waiting for him to kiss her or hug her or something. He says, okay, God bless you. And then we turned and we walked away. It just seemed odd to say goodbye to your wife that way. But that's the way it was then. And so she's saying, I wish you were like my brother, because then nobody would think of anything. And the reference to nursing at my mother's breast kind of has implications for verse 2, where she says, I would, you know, bring you to my mother's house, she who used to instruct me. I think the idea, or she who taught me, some Bibles say, the idea here is that she observed her mother nursing the children. And she's learned from her example about nursing. And then she's saying, well, now I wish I could do like my mother did for us and nurse you at my breasts. I would cause you to drink of spiced wine of the juice of my pomegranate. So she is wishing that she could bring him into this most intimate place in their lovemaking where she could actually nurture him with by giving herself to him. So, again, what you see is her being a little bit more aggressive in her lovemaking, a little bolder in her speech, and even regretting that she can't show public affection to him without scorn in that culture. Well, what can we learn here? Maybe wives should sometimes initiate lovemaking. It's okay biblically, I guess. In fact, surveys show that most men wish the wives would initiate lovemaking more instead of waiting for them. So men sometimes like a little bit more initiative or aggression in their wives. And perhaps also we could say that good lovemaking, at least in the Song of Solomon, includes some of these elements. First of all, there's this anticipation. She invites him to the countryside. She says, I've got something, you know, new for you, something old for you. And she seems to be building his expectations and just teasing him. Maybe a better word would be titillating him as he looks forward to this lovemaking in the country. Perhaps creativity in the fact that she changes the location and the setting. It says, come with me to the countryside. She goes beyond what is always expected and what is always predictable. Sometimes lovemaking gets as predictable as paint by numbers. Or maybe we ought to try to be as creative as Picasso and change things up a little bit. Good lovemaking would include foreplay. We see that all through their lovemaking in the Song of Solomon. It's not something that takes place instantly or quickly, but there's verbal and there's physical touch and foreplay. And likewise, I'll call it afterglow, in which they're lying together in bed, tasting again the intoxicating effects of their lovemaking. As it gently moves over like wine over their lips, she says. I think there's an overall lesson here as we observe this very graphic description of love making in the Song of Solomon. We see that there's a slow pace to it all, and there's an enjoyment of it. It's not like a hamburger eaten in three bites. I used to have a friend that would eat his hamburger in three bites and it was all gone. It was more like a meal savored one bite at a time. And I found this chart by Tim LaHaye in his book, How to Be Happy Though Married. And I can't even read all of it, I don't think. But what it's showing is how the difference of how a man engages in the sexual act and how he is excited and then relaxes, and how a woman is different. And the man is stimulated more quickly, capable of making love quickly, climaxing, and then falling off, going to sleep, or getting a sandwich, whichever. The female, however, it's a longer stimulation period, a longer lovemaking period, and then after the climax, there's a longer cooling off, or afterglow, we'll call it, period. And it's good for a couple, I think, to know about that with one another. And there's a lot of good books that talk about this. It's not the purpose of this course to get into too much of that. But there's a lot of good books like Tim LaHaye's or Ed Wheat's book, and probably newer books too, that describe these kind of things to make it a more effective sexual relationship. And at the end of the our section today, in chapter 8, verses 3 and 4, she admonishes sexual chastity, something that she's done before. First of all, though, she expresses this very intimate description here. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. We mentioned the first time that this is obviously a very sexual position. And some people even prefer to translate the idea of embracing as fondling or caressing. So it's a position of his right hand holding her, and his left hand holding her, and his right hand caressing her. It's also been pointed out, which is of great interest, that in the female sexual anatomy, most women do not achieve orgasm in the act of intercourse. So did God make a mistake in design, or did he intend other stimulation before or after intercourse? Something for you to think about. Again, I think the books do a better job than I would have explained and going into detail about that without blushing. But anyway, it's a very intimate embrace that she's describing here. And it seems to imply that he is caressing her, that is needed, and that's a part of their lovemaking. And that seems to be verified by what we know about sex and sex anatomy. And then in verse 4, she says something that she's said before as well. I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. And she will say that again in chapter 8. But this admonition followed as before her detailed the description of his loving embrace. And so it seems to close the sections of some of the songs. And what she's doing is telling the daughters or the young daughters of Jerusalem or the young maidens, the young marriageable women in the land, don't get ahead of yourself. Don't stir up love until it's ready. The word stir up has the idea of excite or stimulate. I like the word titillate because that kind of often is used in sexual language. And so there's the right time for the sexual part of love, and that time is in marriage. So what I think she's saying is encourage sex within marriage. What the Bible's teaching us is to encourage sex within marriage. And I think there's two sides to this. One is the married side. Sex within marriage is holy and pure. It's to be enjoyed. and we should not be ashamed of it. We should not discourage it. We should not avoid it. We should not apologize for it. And on the other hand, for unmarried, sex is something to be considered special and pure. It shouldn't be trivialized or made common or profane. But it should be anticipated with eagerness. And we should encourage unmarried folks to wait for it. It is worth waiting for. So, sex is great, so wait. Sex is great, so wait. And the more a person is willing to wait, I think the greater the experience will be. Interesting that the New Testament calls having sex with another person, being one body with that person. Even if a person goes out and has sex with a prostitute, Paul describes it as a one-body experience. I think that's because the act is so close and intimate that it's hard not to become one in some way with that person. I don't think he's talking about marriage, as some people have interpreted that. Some people have actually interpreted that any time a person has sex with another person of the opposite sex, that person is married to her in the eyes of God and in the Scriptures, and I don't believe that. But Paul is saying there's something about that experience that's very intimate, and he calls it being one body with her. If that is true, and that is also a description that of what marriage is supposed to be, then young people who are becoming one bodies, or what do they call it these days, hooking up, hanging out, going out, whatever, sleeping with other people, are just diluting the one body experience that God intended for the marriage relationship and making it less special. Not that it can't be special, but we have to admit it can't probably be everything God wanted it to be, but it can still be special. And Hebrews 13:4 says, marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled, but fornicators and adulterers God will judge. Fornication and adultery is, and God's judgment of that is the fence that He has placed around a very special relationship. And I think the idea of God judging that is a negative to reinforce the positive purity of sex in the marriage relationship. But it is honorable to all, and the bed undefiled. So this is a positive statement about the purity of marital love. It is great, so wait. It's worth waiting for. And of course, we live in a society where it makes it very, very difficult to do that, where you can't have a television scene or a movie without people so supposedly falling in love, jumping in the bed, and then maybe getting married as an afterthought, or supposedly as a climax to the movie. But yeah, it doesn't it dilute some quite a bit in your eyes when you're watching a movie when they've been sleeping together and then they finally get married? Common sense and experience tells us that that's not the full impact of what God wants us to have. But yet, this is again a picture of an ideal situation, ideal couple, and an ideal setting, and ideal love, and ideal love making. And we live in a sin-scarred world and lead sin-scarred lives, and so very little is ideal about how you and I have lived our lives. But yet God can make much of what we have to offer Him. And marriage and sex can be restored, probably not in an ideal state. You might think you have an ideal marriage, good for you, but ours isn't perfect, and I suspect yours isn't either, or nor will it be if you're single. But we have to live in a world of sin and its effects, and trust in God's power to protect us and to control us, to forgive us, to give us the strength to do what's good and what's right, and then to teach others the same thing. So, in this session today, in this lesson today, what we see in chapter 7 through 8, verse 4, is the love of these two people getting deeper and more bold in their expression of their physical love. And she takes quite a bit of the initiative. Remember, the story of the Song of Solomon is largely told from her perspective. And she's taking a lot of the initiative here and just saying, because of his love for her that was expressed earlier, like in chapter 6, she's just totally his, totally a comfort and at ease with him, so that she opens up and blossoms and feels more secure in being the initiator and being intimate with him. Beautiful picture of marital love, and it just as a personal testimony, as I teach this, you know, I've taught it before, but I did it in larger sections. I never had to go into so much detail. And to prepare this, you know, I'm sitting there studying. I'm saying, boy, how am I going to say that, you know? To really teach what it's saying is, if you're not used to talking about things in public like I'm not, it's a little difficult to teach. But I've tried to be faithful to what is there and what it means. It just amazes me. I just shake my head and say, God, did you really say that? I mean, but that's what I'm saying all week long as I study this book. That God really is saying that. And he's not just exalting love in this book. He's exalting love making in this book. I mean, there really is that emphasis here. It's not just love with sex on the side. It's really a sexual book from beginning to end, which is just amazing to me that God would do that. And for some reason, you know, Christians have always been painted as thinking sex is dirty and prohibited and being Victorian in their attitudes. Well, those people have not read the Song of Solomon nor understood it, if they say that about God and Christians, because there's hardly a more explicit book written. It's just that it uses poetic language to hide it from the eyes of young people and those who don't really care to know the meaning. But in Hebrew culture, they did not allow people under 30. Some of the rabbis didn't allow people under 30 to read the book because they understood its graphic nature. So it's been interesting. Well, do you have any comments or questions? We have a minute or two. It's amazing how this book just leaves people with no comments or questions. Excellent. Excellent. I'm just repeating this for the sake of the recording, but Sherry's pointed out how she's heard how the intimacy between husband and wife is also an expression of the intimacy between God, the bridegroom, and the church, or us as the bride. And I say amen to that, and I'm going to say more about that next week, actually, because that's how I kind of want to finish the book and then step back and say, what is going on here in the whole book? How does this point us towards God? And we'll talk about that next week. So, excellent.